Mr. Nussbaum.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Mr. Putt, this case involves what Judge Barker aptly phrased in her summary judgment, a botched business venture for the construction of a hotel in White Pigeon, Tennessee. I think to help explain.
Mr. Nussbaum, before we get into the merits, I have a question about subject matter jurisdiction. Where is Mr. McMahon living?
Mr. McMahon is a North Carolina resident. Actually, he's living outside the country.
Yes. That's why I asked that question. The district court said that he's a resident of Athens, Greece. He's still there?
I believe so, Your Honor.
How long has he been in Athens?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, unfortunately, without knowing the answer to that question, I don't think we can say we have jurisdiction in this case. Here's the problem, which apparently both sides and the district judge were unaware of. You seem to be of the assumption that every U.S. citizen must be a citizen of a state, and that turns out to be not true. There is a rule that a U.S. expatriate is not a citizen of any state and cannot either sue or be sued under the diversity jurisdiction. That rule was most recently stated by the Supreme Court in Newman Green against Alfonso Lorraine about 20 years ago, which also came from this court in an almost identical situation. So if Mr. McMahon is an expatriate, that is, if he is living in Athens and plans to remain there, he is not a citizen of North Carolina or of any other state and cannot sue or be sued under the diversity jurisdiction. And then there's no subject matter jurisdiction in this case. So what do we know about Mr. McMahon? Apparently you don't know very much about Mr. McMahon.
Well, what I knew about Mr. McMahon was he had a corporation named Windforge that was a North Carolina corporation, and that he did
That's fine, but if the only party in this case was Windforge, then all we would care about is Windforge's citizenship. But Mr. McMahon, there are two plaintiffs, McMahon and Windforge. And they both have to be citizens of some state different from any of the defendants. Now, there are two ways we can proceed. One, you could amend the allegations of jurisdiction, even in the Court of Appeals, to reveal whether or not Mr. McMahon is intending to remain in Athens or some place other than the U.S. We need to know his domicile, in other words. And these papers just don't reveal his domicile. They certainly raise the possibility that his domicile is outside the United States. And if so, he's not a citizen of any state. The other possibility is he could dismiss himself as a litigant in this case. And the case would proceed with the other parties. Newman Green held that that's permissible, and it saves the existence of jurisdiction where we have an expatriate. But one or the other of those is essential, because otherwise jurisdiction is not established on this record.
Then, Your Honor, what I would request is that we be given the opportunity to amend our jurisdictional statement and give the court more information with regard to Mr. McMahon so that the court will be satisfied this court has jurisdiction.
I will give both sides 14 days after the argument to file any appropriate papers, including a dismissal or amending the pleadings to show jurisdiction, which so far has not been shown.
What individual claims is McMahon pursuing at this point?
None that I can see.
Well, at the conclusion of the evidence at trial, Mr. McMahon, the counsel requested that Mr. McMahon remain as a party, because if in fact the court found that the underlying claim was against Windforge and against Mr. McMahon as it relates to the loan agreement was not well founded, that Mr. McMahon wanted the opportunity to be able to assert that set off as a continuing as a party, and the court allowed that.
As a set off, but he has no individual claim.
There's no claim.
The contract was between Windforge and the defendants, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's no pursuit of any individual claim on his part.
No, except that he was sued by the defendants in this case.
Well, that's a different problem. Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Our case, Your Honor, it involves basically two issues. We believe that the court erred in finding that there was not a contract that was entered into between the parties on or about April 13th or April 14th, 2004. We believe that there was clear evidence, convincing evidence of that, and we say that, first of all, the contract was signed by all the parties. In fact, it was signed twice by all the parties. It was signed in the body of the contract, and then the scope of work section, which was, there was a lot of time spent in the court's decision and in this case, that was also signed separately, that it was agreed to and executed on
right.
April.
It was also called preliminary, right?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Okay, so why doesn't the word preliminary in the scope of work at least raise some ambiguity as to the party's intent,
well,
as to whether that was intended to be binding?
I think, Your Honor, you have to look at the fact that this contract was negotiated by sophisticated parties, that there were drafts that were going back and forth, that...
Now, why can't a sophisticated party say it's still preliminary?
Well, I mean, no one... The fact
there
of the matter
was a trial in this case,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Right. The fact of the matter is that no one said that. No one raised the issue of preliminary. In fact, the defendants admitted in their answer that there was a contract. They also filed a motion to compel arbitration based upon the contract itself approximately 3.5 years after the case began. And in that motion to compel, they admitted that there was a contract.
And they lost. You opposed that motion. They lost it, right?
So they lost the motion because of the untimeliness of it.
Okay.
We were getting ready to go to trial in 2 months.
So let's go back to my question. Preliminary. Why isn't that a sufficient foundation for the district judge to say this document is ambiguous and I want to look at some parole evidence as to whether the parties intended to be bound by it?
Well, I think the evidence in this case showed that the fact that the word preliminary was on that document was simply because it was put on at the beginning and didn't get taken off at the end.
But the district judge didn't see it that way, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Let's take it a step at a time. First, would you agree that the word preliminary itself raises an ambiguity about
yes.
intent to be bound? Okay.
Yeah, I think it raises a question.
Okay. So then that becomes a factual question that allows parole evidence, correct?
Well, I think you have to determine whether or not there are undisputed facts. It's undisputed the word preliminary is on that piece of paper.
Okay.
It's
you
also
just, you just told me that that's sufficient to create an ambiguity that allows parole evidence, right? So given that, the district court heard parole evidence about the course of negotiations and ultimately concluded as a matter of fact that the parties never intended to be bound. Why is that a clearly erroneous finding of fact?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I think that we are in a situation, and we have argued that this is a de novo review. I think the parole evidence
that
the...
You've just taken it out of de novo review by agreeing that we have an ambiguity and a question of fact.
Well, as a matter of law, I think your question was, is it ambiguous as it relates to between the parties? It might have been ambiguous as it relates between the parties, but they didn't see it that way because the word preliminary wasn't taken out and they went ahead and signed the document.
Okay, that's a factual argument. Why was the district judge's finding of fact about intent to be bound clearly erroneous?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, much of what she based that on was evidence that occurred long after the contract was signed. If you look at what happened at the time the contract was signed, it's clear that the parties intended to be bound.
That's a conclusion.
And I think the court earlier in a previous argument indicated it's very important in these cases that if litigants bind themselves, that they bind themselves. And in this particular case, they bound themselves by answering the complaint in the affirmative that there was a contract, and secondly, in their motion to compel arbitration, that they explicitly said that there was a contract between the parties.
That's your waiver argument, not an argument on the merits as to clearly erroneous as to whether there was an intent to be bound.
Well, I think, Your Honor, if you look at the totality of the evidence, that it was clear and it would be clearly erroneous for the court to find that there was not a contract. If the court has no further questions at this time, I want to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Nussbaum.
Thank you.
Could I just ask, ask you one question? Who was the general contractor under this contract?
There wasn't any general contractor. The general contractor was never hired. There was a project manager.
Isn't that a problem for your side?
I don't believe so.
Why not?
Because there were obligations that the defendants were supposed to fulfill before a general contractor had to be hired.
Well, would you agree that it blows out of the water your failure to manufacture claim of breach?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Paragraph 4.6, I believe it is, of the development agreement says there's no duty to manufacture until the general contractor accepts drawing specifications and order acknowledgments.
Well, I think to have that to be bound on us, there would have to be a contract at this point. And
wait a minute. You can't get out of it that way. Come on. Look, if there's a contract, its terms include 4.6.
Yes.
Which says no duty to manufacture until the general contractor gives approval. Would you agree that that claim has to fall then? Because your clients never hired a general contractor.
Well, I think the reason why they never hired a general contractor was because of the non-performance of the defendants in this case. And so, therefore, I don't think that in and of itself that we would be precluded from pursuing that claim.
Even though your clients never fulfilled the condition precedent?
Well, we had justifiable reason not to fulfill condition precedent.
Well, so all that does is simply become an echo of your other claims, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Nussbaum. Mr. Putt.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel. I appreciate the court's willingness to afford us another 14 days to try to sort out what's going on with Mr. McMahon. I do know that at one point during the pendency of this matter,
he had... Raise your voice, please.
Yes, Your Honor. I will note that at one point during the pendency of this matter, I had seen an affidavit where he averred that he was a resident of North Carolina, but we haven't been able to figure that out since. So I do appreciate...
A resident of North Carolina is irrelevant. The question is whether he's a citizen of North Carolina.
Very good.
Did anybody investigate whether he ever planned to return to North Carolina?
We're trying to investigate that now.
Even as we speak?
Well, as...
It seems unlikely.
I take it you have a judgment you'd like to collect against him. So.
Very much so, Your Honor. Yes, we do. And we haven't been able to sort all that out. No. But to...
Very disappointing that basic questions of subject matter jurisdiction are just ignored by the parties. By both sides.
I understand.
There was nothing that put me onto this except the statement in Judge Barker's opinion that this man, McMahon, is a resident of Athens, Greece, which ought to put somebody onto the possibility that he's not a citizen of a state. I mean, you'd think that'd be a perfectly straightforward thing to pursue.
Yes, Your Honor. As a point of clarification in terms of his claims in this case, there is a judgment against Mr. McMahon. District Court found at summary judgment that there is a separate loan agreement that's separate and distinct from the purported development agreement, and Mr. McMahon guaranteed that. That's why there's a judgment against him, and that's why I believe that his name is found in this brief, although he's not a party to this contract. Neither is Coachman Industries either. They're not a party to this development agreement or this preliminary scope of work either. It's also should be noted that at the district court rendered some 16 pages of findings of fact, and I don't believe that those have been challenged in any meaningful way, and so this court should accept those findings of fact as true. I'm glad the court asked the question about preliminary being ambiguous, this is the first we've heard that our opponents concede the fact that it is ambiguous, because the district court certainly wrestled with that notion. And actually, her opinion centers on whether preliminary is ambiguous and what facts went into it. And she found that there were clear indications and significant evidence of continued negotiation beyond the signature of that contract.
Mr. Putt, let me ask you about that. I'm a little bit concerned about the possibility, in essence, about those continuing negotiations being given too much weight. Because, look, in any complicated contract, the parties are going to expect that there will be details. Let's assume a less dysfunctional relationship than in this particular transaction. But there will be continuing details, certainly in construction contracts all the time. And so the fact that they might anticipate continuing negotiations about details ordinarily would not be enough to undermine the validity of an agreement. It might give rise to ambiguity about specific terms, but not about whether there's an agreement.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that point because I wrestled with the same issue. What's the difference between a continuing negotiation and a subsequent modification? I think it's either or happened here. And the judge at the district court level certainly found that we had a series of continuing negotiations in this regard. And the distinguishing factor is that this scope of work was preliminary. And there was evidence at the trial court that there was some urgency to move this project along. And in order to do that, they wanted something signed, and therefore they signed what they did. And it's preliminary. Just because something is signed doesn't mean it's enforceable as a contract if the parties didn't meet. And what that subsequent evidence shows you, Your Honor, is that the parties didn't act in a manner consistent with this notion that they had a contract. You raised the question about who the general contractor was. There never was a general contractor until shortly before the building permit was pulled, and that's because Majic Craft or All American Homes sought out a general contractor after Windforge didn't do it. Other things that Windforge didn't do, that contract also requires that a formal order be submitted to Majic Craft or All American Homes before the manufacture begins. They didn't do that. It requires that 10% of the contract price to be paid down before the manufacturer must begin building the modular units. That didn't occur either in this case. All of those things, including the general contractor, which you would think if you're building a complex commercial project, you would hire a general contractor out of the gate. None of that stuff happened. And moreover, the continuing negotiations, that sort of evidence comes forth from right after this preliminary scope of work was signed. Windforge came back to Majic Craft and said, we would like to save some additional money, and so we're going to take from you the sprinkler system design, and we're going to take from you the HVAC design, and we're going to take from you the rubber roof design, essentially, too. We're going to take that out of your scope of work. If you look at the proposed, it's called the proposed price list, which I think is Exhibit C, those line items add up to something like $320,000 that was moved from Majic Craft or All American Homes bucket over to Windforge's. And the problem with that, after Windforge assumed responsibility for that, either through a modification or because they just took it as part of ongoing negotiations, they didn't follow through. And the court's evidence shows...
Is this the June 04 modification you're talking about?
The date shifts, but yes, certainly by June 04, that's when it happened. I believe the district court found that that took place then.
Okay.
If it's either a continuing negotiation that Windforge certainly took that, the finding is there, the finding of fact, it's not challenged as a fact. Or if this is a modification under a breach analysis, what it shows is the facts show that the sprinkler system design is a great example. By December 31, 2004, that date that our opponent would read into this contract as the deadline. There was no general contractor, there was no down payment, none of that stuff. But also the sprinkler system design hadn't been completed by Windforge. And in January of 2005, Coachman, as the lender, went to Windforge and said, guys, you're not moving this project forward. We're not going to allow any further draws. You've already taken out some, $1 million. We're not moving forward here until you show some progress. That led Windforge to submit additional sprinkler system designs in March, I think, was of 2005, that was submitted to the third-party administrator, and they received a deviation report in, I think it was April of 2005 or May of 2005, that still said the sprinkler design is defective, as was the fire alarm design that was WindForge's issue and this smoke egress door in the lobby, which was a common area, which was also WindForge's issue. Those weren't resolved until August of 2005. And on August 29 of 2005, All American Homes at that time, who had assumed the obligations of Montague Craft in the contract, submitted yet another set of plans for review, and the third-party administrator kicked them back and said, you're approved. And the state said, you're approved, here's your letter of filing. Legally, at that point in time, was the first time All American Homes or Montague Craft could have actually begun manufacturing the units, because the evidence also showed that the state had ruled here, and in somewhat of an unusual situation, that even though the modular unit designs were complete and there were no defects in the modular unit designs as of, I think it was April 2004, that we couldn't proceed until all of those other designs were worked out, those designs which WindForge specifically assumed. And as of that time, in August of 2004, when we get that letter of filing, All American Homes still can't proceed because there's no general contractor. And no general contractor had pulled the building permit. And there was still no order placed, and there was still no 10% down. Montague Craft and All American Homes at this time wanted to move the project along, and after some time, waiting for WindForge still to get the general contractor to pull the building permit, actually went ahead and went out of pocket to hire a general contractor specifically to get the building permit, and that's when the municipality of Pigeon Forge said, guys, our sewer system is overtaxed at this point in time. Had you done this earlier, we could have allowed you to build the hotel, but we can't now. So the hotel cratered and the project cratered, and that's why we're here today. So whether it's the contract didn't exist, which we contend it didn't because of this ambiguity and the parties pass like ships in the night, not really understanding what each other's responsibilities were, or simply WindForge didn't follow through on its conditions precedent.
Mr. Putt, let me ask you about the issue of waiver on the validity of the contract.
Yes.
It sounds like you all took the position repeatedly that there was, in fact, a binding contract here.
We admitted in the answer that we entered into an agreement, was how it was phrased. There was no discussion at that time about whether it was valid and enforceable, and certainly parties enter into agreements that are later found to be unenforceable. The issue of what the rights of the parties were, who did what, this whole series of facts I just reiterated for you, those were all heavily contested issues throughout the course of the underlying litigation. And this issue was apparent throughout. This wasn't something that, as the appellants contend, was our responsibility to raise and was an affirmative defense. This was their burden of proof to show there was actually a contract in the meeting of the minds. The other thing that bears some analysis is the court's interpretation of the terms of the contract, and WindForge urges this court to identify as the fundamental agreement, I think, this notion that the building is modular units and modular units are the building. The terms of the preliminary scope of work and the development agreement in and of themselves show that's not an accurate statement. There were many things that WindForge was supposed to do, including building walls and porte cochères and covered walkways and ceilings and floors and common areas. In terms of the written agreement itself, shows that there are more than modular units in any given building, and I think common sense tells us that too. Moreover, what WindForge doesn't really address with this argument is that the contract was also modified orally and through the conduct of the parties, in which at that time the responsibility for things like we just discussed, the sprinkler system design in particular, was transferred from one party to the other.
You're fading out again, Mr. Putt. Would you kindly raise your voice?
Yes.
You can pull the microphone.
No. It's a bad idea. Oh, okay. Just leave the microphone alone.
Sorry. Okay.
You just need to raise your voice.
I apologize. So in conclusion, then, What we're really left is, no matter whether a contract existed or whether a contract didn't, is that there were certain obligations that Windforge undertook that never occurred. Chief among them is the general contractor. Chief among them is the building permit, the completion of designs, the payment of the down payment, the placement of the order. The trial court was correct then in finding that there was no way, even if you could read into the agreement, and I don't think you could, but even if you could read into the agreement that December 31, 2004 was something of a deadline, that there was no way Mongeacraft possibly could have performed by that time. And there was no, frankly, there was no way that Mongeacraft or All American Homes ever could have performed. So with that, I will conclude, and I will gladly answer any further questions the panel may have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Putt. Anything further, Mr. Nussbaum?
Yes, Your Honor. A couple of responses to what Mr. Putt had to say. He indicated that it was impossible for either Mongeacraft or All American Homes to perform before December 31, 2004. That is in direct contravention to what the evidence showed that they represented to the broker in this deal, that this whole project could be done in 11 weeks. I think that's
when,
When
did they make that representation?
They made that representation prior to the time that Mr. McMahon and Windforge were introduced to them. That, based upon that representation, Mr. Lee, who was interested in building a modular hotel, then pursued further to find someone like Mr. McMahon and Windforge, who had a relationship with a hotel developer and had some land available to bring these parties together. But it was clear that part of the best case for at that time Mongeacraft was that they could in fact do something within 11 weeks. And it's interesting that the June 23, 2004 date is about 10 weeks after the April 16, 2004 contract was signed, when nothing had occurred. And at that time, Mr. McMahon began to insert himself more into the situation because he could see that things were going south and he needed to do so.
Could I ask you,
sure,
Mr. Nussbaum, about some things in your brief?
Sure.
The district court focused pretty heavily on Section 1.2 of the scope of work provision. You'll recall that that's something that you all were relying upon pretty heavily. In your brief, you quoted it, but left out the sentence that the district court was relying upon. I'm troubled by that in terms of the candor with the court and whether it actually confronts the reasoning of the district court that you're trying to show was erroneous.
Well, our position all along, Your Honor, was that the position of 1.2 and 1.4 and 1.3 and all the others were, in fact, clearly, as I think the district court said. Yes, I do.
You understand my point. The district court relied upon the language to include only materials and on-site services specified as supplied by MUK. Now, that may or may not be right. It may or may not give the district court the weight, or deserve the weight that the district court gave it. But for you to delete that language when you are giving us the facts is very troubling.
Well, all I can say, Your Honor, it was a mistake. It wasn't intentional.
How can it not be intentional, given the district court's reliance upon it and the centrality of that language to this case?
Well, the actual scope of work was an exhibit in this case. It was examined by the district court. I don't think there's any way any of the parties could say that they were somehow misled by what was put in the brief.
You all know the case very well. We learn it to prepare for oral argument. We ought to be able to rely upon briefs. We obviously do not, and cannot in your case, but that's very troubling. I just want that to be clear.
I understand your point, Your Honor. And my response to that is that we apologize for that error. It was not meant to be intentional.
The case is taken under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.